Oh, okay. Is
You might need to speak up a little.
Okay, I'll try to speak loudly. Let me first thank the organizers for having me here. This is quite an interesting mix of people. All right, so I'm going to be talking about the complexity of this problem, and so really this is the problem of, or this is the question of whether N representability is computationally easy or hard. So in a way, this is really a generalization of what we've been thinking about with these N representability conditions. That here we're asking, really, is there any computationally efficient solution to the problem? And such a solution could consist of a list of representability conditions, but it could also be something quite different. It could be an algorithm. It could be some kind of adaptive procedure that simply tries to determine representability. And the only restriction we want is that this is computationally efficient. So for instance, if it's a list of representability conditions, you would like such a list to be short. So the main results that I'm going to present are actually quite theoretical, I think they're actually quite useful because these are fairly fundamental questions, just that questions you should be asking when you first set up the problem. Do you expect to find an exact solution or not? Or should you, from the beginning, just limit your expectations to approximate solutions? And again, also, should you be expecting to simply solve this problem in its full generality? Or do you, from the outset, have to restrict yourself to special cases? And it's my belief that the theoretical understanding of these questions actually complements practice, and that usually when something works well in practice, there is some kind of theoretical justification for it. And when the theory says it's hard, it usually means that sooner or later you do run into practical difficulties. Okay? And so, the main result here is that N representability is QMA complete. And this, this is sort of a quantum version of the notion of NP completeness. And this says that solving the problem exactly in the worst case is hard in some sense. So this will be the main result that I'll talk about. But at the end, hopefully, I'll be able to say a little bit more, because I think that perhaps we can say a little bit more, actually. That QMA completeness means more than just that a problem is hard. It also means that its complexity is intimately related to that of many other problems, which are also QMA complete. And so this actually should suggest ideas for solving it. In particular, there are approximation algorithms for many NP-complete problems. And some of these are actually related to the ideas that show up in these P-positivity conditions. They're actually related to SDP hierarchies, which are used to solve other problems like vertex cover or max cut. So I'll save that for the end, but somehow the message is that complexity theory is a unifying tool which can allow you to better understand algorithmic techniques in other contexts, and also, vice versa, to borrow ideas from other fields. Okay, so I'll start out just by talking here about complexity theory. I'll give you a brief introduction to these notions of completeness, and then I'll talk about the main result. Let me say that basically, the pedestrian way of saying this result is that if there existed an efficient algorithm for N representability, then there would exist efficient algorithms for all QMA problems. And so this is precisely why we believe that such a thing is not possible. So the technical tools are somewhat interesting. So one of them is a special kind of convex optimization. And the reason this arises is that the whole point of the N representability approach is to be able to use convex optimization to find ground states. But in fact, it's the same idea in a somewhat specialized form that gives us this hardness result. And the other tool is a mapping from qubits to fermions, and this arises because the class QMA is naturally defined using qubits, but it turns out that we can actually go back and forth between the language of qubits and fermions. So let me start. So this is complexity theory, and here are a few of the obligatory acronyms. The two, so complexity theory tries to put it tries to classify problems according to their difficulty. And you know, and the two important classes that I'll be talking about are P and NP. So P is problems that can be solved in polynomial time, and we think these are computationally easy. NP is the class of problems that can be solved in non-deterministic polynomial time, which, you know, which doesn't have a terribly natural physical interpretation, but you know, but this will turn out to be a very important class. And then, you know, in fact, there are some of these other classes which are higher up in the complexity hierarchy, and you know, and so I'll actually get to that in a moment, but it's essentially saying that if you could guess the solution, then you would at least be able to check it efficiently. You know, and so within NP there's this class of NP complete problems, and these are the problems that are at least as hard as any other problem in NP. And you know, and so we can't solve them efficiently unless P equals NP. And the real motivation for defining NP completeness is that actually many, many practical problems are NP complete. There are things like the traveling salesman problem, or graph coloring, or vertex cover, finding the ground state energy of an Ising model with, you know, with non-uniform interaction strengths. These are all NP complete problems. And so it's really these problems that motivate the importance of NP completeness. You know, so here's a bit of terminology that people talk about: NP completeness and NP hardness. And what this, you know, so the distinction between the two is that NP hardness means a problem is as hard as any problem in NP, but it could actually be harder. NP complete just means that it is NP hard, but it also belongs to P, so it sits right at that level. And you know, and so let me say that it's NP completeness. Okay, NP completeness is a very successful theory in the sense that it describes the complexity of many problems that arise in practice. I mean, there are really very few problems that are not either NP or and are also not known to be NP complete. So in that sense, the theory is powerful. And there are some caveats that problems in P are not always easy in practice, but at least there's hope that you could try to design better algorithms. And problems that are NP hard are not always hard in practice, but we know that there exist hard instances. Okay? And so this is complexity theory as it was originally developed. You know, so this is where it stood as of maybe the early 1990s. And since then, people have tried to push this a little bit further. So they've tried to understand some things which remained mysterious. One of them is, yeah. So NP hard means a problem is at least as hard as any problem in NP. It means that if you could solve this problem efficiently, then you could solve every problem in NP. However, it's possible for a problem to be NP hard, and in fact, it's actually strictly harder than any problem in NP. Yes, you know. So NP completeness means that a problem is NP hard, but it's also in the class NP. So it's both an upper and a lower bound on the complexity. Okay. One thing people have noticed in practice is that some NP complete problems definitely seem harder than others. You know, and a famous example is the traveling salesman problem, which in practice is almost always easy, actually. I mean, there are simple heuristic methods, and they do really, really well in practice. You don't get the optimal solution, but you get within a few percent of optimal in terms of the cost of the solution. Graph coloring is a whole different story, on the other hand. There are not good algorithms in practice for graph coloring. There simply aren't. People have heuristics, but they can't solve very large instances, and the quality of solution is not very good. So more recently, people have actually managed to find some theoretical justifications for this empirically observed phenomena. And so for traveling salesmen, the thing that we can prove theoretically is that there exist good approximation algorithms. These are algorithms that find solutions whose quality is almost as good as as optimal. And the particular thing that we have are these polynomial time approximation schemes. So that basically those show that if you fix any epsilon, or let's say any 1 plus epsilon, then in polynomial time you can find a solution whose quality is at most 1 plus epsilon times the cost of an optimal solution. And you can do this for any epsilon. So depending on how much time you're willing to spend, you can achieve any fixed approximation ratio. You know, so this is the theoretical justification for why you can get pretty good solutions in practice in polynomial time. And you know, and so these approximation algorithms, they use a little bit of structure about the problem. They work when the graph is, so they work in particular in Euclidean space, when distances between cities are in some Euclidean metric. Okay.
But what happens if both of those are empty complete graphs?
Mm-hmm.
So I mean, what happens if you just take a graph selling problem and map it to traffic sales when you use approximation? Does that fail?
Yeah. So that fails because when you do this mapping, it doesn't preserve the quality of near optimal solution.
So is there any way to? I mean, is there anything known about? I mean, this is an obvious question, so maybe it's a research question. But is there anything known about how could you use that mapping and then invert it at all? Or
so, I mean, so when people try to do it, they find that they can't get these kinds of mappings to work. I guess but the strongest evidence for why it's not possible is actually this last bit, that in fact you can show that finding solutions that are within a constant factor of optimal for graph coloring is NP hard. Okay. Sorry?
Regardless of what other problem you might map it on.
Yeah. It looks like you can't do it. And so this is the celebrated PCP theorem. Okay.
What's
it? It stands for probabilistically checkable proofs.
And we're saying that coupling itself is probably busy, and it's not empty essentially.
Right. Unless, yeah.
Is that white column for the hardest instances or for typical?
So these are all for worst case behavior. Yeah. Okay. So that's the other thing that actually we still don't understand. What is average case complexity, when you just look at typical instances, and so there are some results that are for random instances of a problem, like random subset sum or random bin packing. But you know, here the problem is that most of the time you don't even know how to ask the right question because you don't know what is the distribution of instances that occur in practice. So, you know, this is somehow very frustrating that there's no way to theoretically formalize the problem of what happens in practice. You know, and likewise there's a similar problem with average case performance of algorithms. Theoretically, you don't know what the underlying distribution is. You know, and so people of course, when you have an algorithm, you can just run it and you can get experimental results. And here the real question is whether these results actually generalize. You know, whether they generalize to larger instances, to different families of instances, you know, and whether the running time of your computer is really a reflection of the underlying strength of the algorithm, or if it's the strength of your SDP solver, or if it's the quality of your basis set. You know, all of these things are somehow conflated when you look at the experimental results. So this is, you know, so these are the inevitable pitfalls of experimental evaluation of algorithms. So, okay, so you know, that's the high level picture. But you know, let me now start defining these things more precisely. So the class NP. A problem is an NP if its solution can be verified efficiently. And more precisely, this means that there exists a polynomial time algorithm V, the verifier. And V takes two inputs. It takes X, which is a description of the instance of the problem, and it takes a witness string Y, which I'll come to in a moment. The point is that the witness is at most polynomially larger than the description of the instance, and the verifier either accepts or rejects. So a problem is an NP if you can construct a verifier that behaves in the following way. If the answer to the problem is yes, then there exists a witness which will cause the verifier to accept. And if the answer to the problem is no, then for all possible witnesses, the verifier will reject. Okay? And yeah, so you've probably seen this before, but like if the problem is graph coloring, then the witness is a coloring of the vertices, and you can check that efficiently. Okay? Okay, so this is NP. And for our purposes, I actually need to generalize that a bit. So we're interested in problems involving the ground states of local Hamiltonians. And here's one way to formalize it. Suppose we're just using qubits for now. And we're given a local Hamiltonian, which is a sum of terms that each couple, at most, say two qubits. Okay, and then the problem is the following, that we're given these real numbers A and B that are separated by a gap which is at least inverse polynomial in the number of qubits, and if the ground state energy is at most A, then the answer is yes, and otherwise, if it's greater than B, the answer is no. So this is sort of a simple kind of ground state energy problem. But by solving this problem, you can in fact determine many things about the ground state by taking perturbations of the Hamiltonian and so forth. You can infer other properties of the ground state. And so we want to study this problem, but the difficulty is that local Hamiltonian is not in NP, at least not in the general case, because the natural witness is a copy of the ground state, which is a quantum state. Okay. And so this motivates us, though, to try to fix things by generalizing a quantum notion of NP, which will allow precisely this. So this is the class QMA. Okay, so it's the same thing, except that now the verifier is a quantum algorithm, the witness can be a quantum state, and if the answer is yes, then the verifier accepts with probability at least 2/3, and if the answer is no, then it always rejects with probability 2/3, okay? The canonical result on quantum complexity is that local Hamiltonian is QMA hard. Okay, it's in QMA for reasons which are not too hard to see, and it's QMA hard because if you had an oracle that could solve local Hamiltonian, you could actually solve any problem in QMA, and this is not a very immediate result, but I'm not going to go into detail about it. But this was proved by Kitaev, and it holds even for restricted classes of Hamiltonians, two body terms, nearest neighbors on a 2D lattice, a one-dimensional chain of qubits. You get the idea, and I'm certainly failing to cite some people here. Okay. This is our starting point, and so I'm going to show that N representability is QMA complete. But to start with that, it's actually a bit easier if you simply look at the qubit version. So this is a problem called consistency of local density matrices, and this is somehow the simpler version of the N representability result. Okay, and so in this problem, again, you have a system of n qubits, and you're given local density matrices rho 1 to rho m that each describe a subset of two qubits. And you want to decide whether they're consistent, whether there's a global state that agrees with all of them. And in particular, you want to say yes if there does exist such a state sigma that matches each of the rho i's on its marginals. And you want to say no if for every possible state sigma, it's going to disagree on at least one of these subsets of qubits. So this is a quantum marginal problem where you're concerned with marginals on small subsets of the system. And so this problem was suggested by Dorita Haranov. It's very much in the spirit of N representability, except that here you have qubits, and you're looking at their reduced density matrices. So consistency is in QMA, and this is because the solution can be verified efficiently. This is not too hard to see, but I think I should move on and show you the more interesting part, which is that consistency is QMA hard. Okay, so this is what we want, that given an oracle for consistency, we can solve the local Hamiltonian problem. And, you know, and the idea is one which will be familiar to you because you've seen it a couple of times already, that in order to find the ground state of local Hamiltonian, we're simply going to solve a convex optimization problem that involves finding these local density matrices, rho 1 to rho m, that minimize the energy such that they satisfy this consistency constraint. And, you know, and the idea is that, well, the idea is that we want to use the oracle to test whether the consistency constraint is satisfied. Now, what makes this a little more challenging than just plain semi-definite programming is that here you actually don't have this program written down in an explicit form. You only have this black box that tells you when the constraint is satisfied. And you know the constraint is convex, but that's really all that you know. And so the question is, you know, even in this very, you know, very oracular version of convex optimization, can you still do this efficiently? Okay? You know, and so the answer is yes, that actually you can do convex optimization in surprisingly general settings. You know, so if you imagine that K is some convex set and you're in R to the N and you're given an oracle O that spits out 1 if the point is in K and 0 otherwise. And you're given some unit vector which is really the function, a linear function which you want to optimize, and you're given a starting point inside the set K. Then in general, yes, you can find a point X in K that minimizes this linear function. So the first result of this is due to Yudin and Nemirovsky. It's called the shallow cut ellipsoid method. Since then, there's been some other work. And this is quite remarkable that, you know, you have to make an assumption that the set K is full dimensional. And this is simply so that you don't have to hunt around for the right subspace that you should be working in. But other than that, you can find exact solutions in polynomial time. It's quite incredible. So by exact solutions, I mean that in polynomial time, you can get polynomially many bits of accuracy. That's what I mean by exact. Okay. Now, here things are a little bit more tricky. We're not quite done yet because we actually need to do approximate optimization. So the reason is that I'm actually allowing this oracle for the consistency problem to make errors near the boundary of the set. And in fact, I'm allowing these errors to be quite large in the sense that they're of size inverse polynomial. And to be fair, I'm only asking to solve the local Hamiltonian problem with a similar level of accuracy, plus or minus 1 over poly. But this turns out actually to be a significant departure from the setting of exact optimization. So you need to be careful, and the upshot of it is that you need to assume a little bit more about the set K. You need to assume that it's full dimensional and it's not too. You need to assume that it's well conditioned in the sense that it contains a ball of radius little r. It's bounded outside by radius big R, and the ratio between those two is at most polynomially large. Okay, and it turns out that this is true for the set that we're considering, the set of consistent local density matrices. Okay, now you can basically get the result, and there's a bit more work to do. That, you know, you want to represent this set K in the right way, and well, one right way of doing it is to encode all of these reduced density matrices as the expectation values of local Pauli operators. And, you know, and when you do this, then the set K of consistent expectation values has these nice geometric properties, and you can plug it in. And so you get that if you have an efficient algorithm for consistency, then you can solve this optimization problem, and you can solve local Hamiltonian. Okay. Okay, and so there's a little bit more to say about this, and it concerns the numerical precision. So the precise statement of this result is that for any epsilon, there exists a delta which is not too small, such that if the oracle has error delta, then the algorithm for optimization will achieve error epsilon. And the point is that that delta and error, delta and epsilon are polynomially related. And so in truth, the polynomial relating delta and epsilon is pretty awful. And you know, it's not very civilized to discuss the matter in much greater detail than that, but it is quite bad.
Bad as in complicated or bad as in high scale?
Bad as in high degree. But one thing that I want to emphasize to you is that it's also true that pretty much, so most of the N representability conditions that people have considered actually give you more than just a membership oracle for the set. Because when they're violated, they allow you to find a separating hyperplane that cuts off a given point from the convex set. And so, you know, so if you have this ability, then actually this is much stronger than just a membership oracle. So this is called, in the literature, this is called a separation oracle. And if you have a separation oracle, then this relation between delta and epsilon becomes much tamer. So in fact, the problem of solving consistency or M representability and finding separating hyperplanes, this is QMA-hard with much more forgiving levels of accuracy. Okay, so, yeah.
What is it? Is it like to the 100th power or to the 100th power? How bad is awful?
Well, those are both really awful, but
okay.
The exponent 73 comes to mind.
There's different levels of awful.
I think a lot of this really comes from, you know, from the generality of the result that it works just for a membership oracle. If you have a separation oracle, then actually things are a lot tighter. But okay, and you know, and there, yeah, there's, you know, so there's been some related work in quantum information using these methods that you can get strong NP hardness of a number of problems in quantum information. One neat thing is that actually you can also use the same method to do a reduction in the reverse method, that you can reduce the consistency problem actually to the problem of finding ground states. And this uses SDP duality. And this is quite cute, if only for the conceptual reason that you can really think of these two problems as being duals of each other in some sense. Now let me show you, you know, the full deal. This is the result with Matthias Cristandl and Frank Verstrater, you know, where we showed that the fermionic N representability problem is QMA complete. And the definitions are going to seem quite familiar to you. The one thing to remember is that, so we're looking at a situation where there are N electrons and D modes. And typically, you know, I guess you should imagine, okay, so you should imagine that D equals 2N, really. So we're scaling both the number of electrons and the number of orbitals simultaneously, okay? And it's really the scaling of the number of electrons that makes this thing hard. You should already know what N representability is. I'm going to show that the fermionic version of local Hamiltonian is QMA complete, and also N representability is QMA complete. You know, and it's easy to see that, well, it's not, it's fairly straightforward to see that they're in QMA, and the basic reason is that you can take the natural witness, which is a fermionic state, and encode it into qubits using the Jordan-Wigner transform. Okay. Now, to show that these are QMA hard, there are two steps. So these inequalities, these are reductions. So I'm going to show that qubit local Hamiltonian reduces to fermionic local Hamiltonian. And what I mean is that if you can solve the latter problem, then you can solve the former problem. And the idea here is to use fermions to simulate qubits. And then the second step is to show that fermionic local Hamiltonian reduces to N representability, and this uses the ideas which we already saw. Okay. And So let me quickly sketch this idea of simulating qubits using fermions. You know, so the idea is that we start out with a system of n qubits, and we're going to map it onto a system of n fermions and d equals 2n modes. So each qubit corresponds to a pair of modes, and exactly one of them will be occupied, and that indicates whether the qubit is 0 or 1. Okay? You know, and so the reason for doing it this way is that, you know, is that now this gives, so it turns out that qubit operators will translate nicely into fermionic operators, you know, and these are sort of the natural things you would write down that, you know, like if you want to flip a bit, that corresponds to moving a particle from one mode into the other mode in the pair. And, you know, and the point of these first that these are quadratic expressions, which means that things are going to commute in the way that they should. The second point is that if you start out with two local interactions on qubits, you're going to get two local interactions on fermions, or, you know, so degree four combinations with two annihilation and two creation operators. Okay, this actually works out very nicely. And then the last bit is that you need to constrain each pair of modes to be occupied by exactly one particle, and so you can do this without too much trouble. Okay, so this mapping is nice in that it preserves the ground state energy of the system, you know. Okay, at least in this low energy sector, you know, and then there are going to be some high energy sectors that correspond to, you know, to when these other constraints are violated. Okay. So this is the first step in the reduction, and, you know, and the second step is going to use convex programming. You have to do a little more work in order to represent this n representable set in an appropriate way so that it's full dimensional and it's, you know, and it's not too stretched out in any one direction. And, you know, and this is a bit technical, so I'm just going to skip it. But the point is that essentially the point is that you can actually show that if you let Kn be the set of n representable density matrices, then when you scale things properly, you have this chain of sets because n representability becomes successively a stronger constraint as you increase n. But you also have some relations that come from particle and particle hole duality, which relate, you know, the behavior of, say, you know, a system with two particles to the behavior of a system with two holes, if you're using particle observables and hole observables. And so by playing around with this, you can actually show that all of these sets are nicely behaved, geometrically speaking. So, you know, you can ask me about it later. The place where I want to end is really on, you know, what's the next step from this result. You know, so this shows that n representability is hard in the worst case asymptotically as the size of the problem grows. And there are the obvious caveats which everyone knows, which are that molecular systems sometimes have special structure. You know, you can at least, you know, it appears that they can be solved by methods that incorporate physical intuition. And of course, you know, even if you're stupid, you can just use brute force to solve very small instances. So, you know, so there's all of that. Some related questions include, you know, what happens for these marginal problems in other kinds of systems? Like, so for bosonic systems, there's a recent result which we'll be hearing about soon, which shows that case is also QMA complete. But what if we look, for instance, at translation invariant systems? And here there's actually been quite a bit of work which suggests that marginals or reduced density matrices in translation invariant systems are actually much easier to deal with. So those are some questions to consider. I think Okay, so, you know, so the last thing I want to say is about these P positivity conditions, which, you know, which are, you know, which seem like the natural way of obtaining increasingly strong approximations to N representability. And, you know, and so here, you know, many of you already know this, but this is really a hierarchy of constraints involving the P particle reduced density matrix. And these constraints become stronger as you increase P, so the accuracy improves. However, the computational complexity of solving the problem also scales exponentially in P. So there are some questions about the accuracy of this approximation. I don't think it's necessarily true that accuracy is not something we should at least think about, because if we can improve the accuracy, we can actually trade that off into a speed up in the methods. For instance, if we can get better accuracy using two RDM methods, then that can be translated into a speed up, because that can save you from having to deal with the three electron density matrix. So the two issues are not entirely separate from each other. The other intriguing thing is that these methods are related to things which are used in approximation algorithms for combinatorial optimization. And there's actually quite a nice theory which uses exactly this approach, that you start out with an NP-hard problem, and so often this takes the form of an integer program. And it could be solved if you could do linear programming on the convex hull of the set of integer solutions. Okay, and of course, you know, this is also NP-hard. But now, the solution that is proposed is to take this difficult-to-describe convex set and approximate it from the outside by a much simpler set, which is described by some small set of linear or semi-definite constraints. Okay, and actually, this method does yield a large number of useful approximation algorithms where we can prove bounds on the ratio between the quality of the solution that we get and the quality of an optimal solution. Okay, so this is actually a very general technique. But now there's a particular class of these LP and SDP relaxations which are quite interesting. So this is work due to Lovage and Shriver. And there are also similar constructions by Shirali and Adams and by Lester. And again, these form a hierarchy of relaxations where, again, you know, the higher you go in this hierarchy, the complexity increases exponentially. But intuitively, it seems like you should also be getting much tighter relaxations. Recently, there have been, I guess, some surprising negative results about these hierarchies that actually show that even if you go up to the nth level of the hierarchy, the approximation ratio actually remains essentially as bad as it was when you started. And so this is quite surprising, because when you go up to the nth level, you now get an algorithm that is running in exponential time in n, where n is the size of the problem. So this is already much stronger than anything you could ever hope to do in practice. And yet it's very surprising that the approximation ratio doesn't improve at all. I'm not sure whether I actually believe that such a thing could be true for N representability, because there are a few instances where you can do these hierarchies of SDP relaxations, and you can actually prove that the approximation ratio does improve at every step. So it's not necessarily so bad, but the majority of the results have actually had the strong negative flavor. This to me is simply an interesting connection, If you look at methods which are similar to P positivity but in a different context, those are actually getting to be quite well understood. So maybe it's actually possible to prove something about P positivity, either in the positive direction or in the negative direction. So, am I out of time? Okay.
Yeah.